Hello and welcome to another one-off episode of the House of Commons. My name's Emma Burnell and I'm a political journalist. And I'm joined today by Margaret Bolton, who is the policy director of the Local Trust. Hello, Margaret.
Hello, Emma. It's great to be here with you.
Thank you. So, well, here is a relative term these days, isn't it?
We're virtually here online. Great to Absolutely. Be having a conversation with you.
So, Margaret, tell me all about the Local Trust.
Well, we advocate for communities to have more control over decision making and resources because we firmly believe that that can be transformative. I mean, we've seen it with our own eyes.
Do you want to give me some examples of some of the stuff that you've done?
Well, the main thing that we do is we administer the Big Local Programme, which is a unique and radical experiment in devolution. So each of 150 neighbourhoods across England were awarded £1 million by the National Lottery Community Fund. And we're supporting the residents as they spend that money on activities that they've decided are a priority. So we're now just over halfway through what's the 15-year programme. And we can already see the significant difference that it's made to neighbourhoods and the quality of life of the people living in them.
And how were the 150 neighbourhoods found, selected, chosen?
Right. Well, I think the primary thing was they were chosen because they hadn't previously received their fair share of lottery or other public funding. So they were deemed to be funding cold spots. And also they tended to lack civic or community groups. And so the hypothesis was that for that reason, they lacked people who knew how to apply for funding. Mm. I think the other defining characteristic is that they were all in the top 20% most deprived areas, according to the government's index of multiple deprivation.
And so give me a concrete example of a change in a particular area that you love to talk about.
Okay. The one that I love to talk about is Lawrence Weston, Big Local, which is in North Bristol. And I think they're a particularly impressive group of people. They focused on improving the economic prospects of residents. So, for example, they did some research with a small amount of their Big Local money, demonstrating that a low-cost supermarket would do well on the estate. And on the back of that, they actually recruited one of the big names to come and open a branch. And that's been really important for the area because not only has it created new jobs, but it's also enabled residents to access much cheaper food. And they've done, you know, other brilliant entrepreneurial things, like they've developed community housing, they've set up a solar farm, and they're currently working with a company on a wind turbine project. And I asked them actually what they, how they would define success for their area. And they said that success for them would be if the young people on the estate started to have much higher aspirations and started to believe that, you know, they could become doctors or lawyers. And, you know, it's evident that that's happening, that the way people feel about the area and that the way young people feel about their own prospects has really changed as a result of Big Local and, you know, other community mobilisation efforts.
And in terms of the Local Trust's impact and input to that, obviously you're very keen on sort of bottom-up, community-driven work. So what's your role in ensuring that that happens?
So our role is to support the areas. So so as I said, you know, they determine the priorities for the spend, but then we work with them to try and ensure that the money is spent well. So I think that the sort of core of our work is helping the areas network and learn from each other. So we bring them together to discuss, you know, particular issues that they're responding to, which might be housing related. You know, it might be about addressing loneliness and isolation. It may be about trying to influence the public sector to improve services. And what they say is really powerful is, you know, that element of peer inspiration and support, you know, exchanging tips on, you know, how to be more effective.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, and that can be invaluable, can't it? And it's yeah. what some people have kind of, you know, they have that network already of influencers, and they already know how to do all that. And, you know, that kind of social capital that we talk about is so, so valuable.
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely. And, you know, and we see areas develop really strong networks, you know, so we see them being able to broker, you know, sometimes quite significant funding into their areas. You know, we see them able to broker people who have really quite defined areas of expertise that can enable them to develop their projects.
And obviously we're in a very strange time at the moment. How much has this impacted on, because one would assume that an awful lot of this work happens face to face.
Yes, yes, it's true that a lot of the work does happen face to face. And obviously a lot of big locals had to suspend most of their face-to-face services at the point of lockdown. But many quickly managed to transfer at least some of their services online. So, for example, mentoring and youth clubs. And we've been helping areas develop their digital skills and confidence to enable them to make that shift.
And how's it affecting your work? Because it must be hard for you to keep in touch with everybody in ways that you would have done otherwise.
I think it, yes, although we very quickly, you know, got onto Zoom, like the rest of the world.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've been hosting regular weekly Zoom drop-in sessions for our areas, you know, where they've come together to talk about what they're doing in response to COVID-19, and where they're able to discuss sort of issues and barriers and come up with solutions. So I think the reason I hesitated in response to your question is it hasn't really felt that difficult a transition, surprisingly. You know, we've managed to keep in touch with people, and, you know, we've had a really interesting feedback from areas about what they're doing, really inspiring feedback. Mm-hmm. And I think we've been able to continue to support them.
And in terms of, yeah, I'm obviously this is a terrible crisis, and one doesn't want to be glib, but have you seen any positives coming out of what's happened?
Well, I think the obvious thing is that there's been an enormous upsurge in volunteering and neighbours helping each other out. And we've really seen how important very local community action, you know, at the level of a street or a housing estate, is ensuring that the needs of the most vulnerable are met. So I think, you know, there's a positive in terms of, you know, people returning to this sense of community. And, you know, a sense of, you know, wanting to give back and contribute. I mean, I'd say there's been a massively increased sense of social solidarity, and that can only bode well for the future.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I also think, in particularly in terms of your work, that neighbourhoods have become absolutely essential. You know, most of this is set up on a neighbourhood basis, isn't it? Rather than, you know, while there are big national institutions that we're all, you know, very aware of, actually an awful lot is happening on a neighbourhood level by necessity.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I think, I mean, the other reflection that I'd make on it is that, You know, when I look at the way that big locals have responded to COVID-19, they are doing really amazing work, making sure that the needs of their residents, and particularly vulnerable residents, are being met during the crisis. And, you know, for many of them, that's building on work that they were already doing. So provision of food banks, schemes to address holiday hunger, and initiatives to reduce loneliness and isolation amongst residents. So things like knit and natter groups and mental health workers on estates. But what we've really seen is the strength of that sort of local action, because what big local areas are really strong on is knowing the needs of their residents. So I think they've come into their own in the response because of that deep local knowledge. So they know who's vulnerable, they know who urgently requires help, and, you know, they know people's particular needs. So a really good example that was given to me the other day is, you know, elderly people who don't cook anymore, providing food packages. Well, they aren't much use. So what a lot of our areas have been doing is actually providing ready meals or hot meals, you know, to those older people who don't cook anymore. And they're able to do that because of, you know, the deep local knowledge that I've already mentioned, but also because of their strong local networks. You know, they know the residents who have the vans, who can help them deliver. They've got very good connections with, you know, local shop owners who can donate food. So I feel that their strengths have really come to the fore during this crisis.
Mm, absolutely. And how do going forward, when as the crisis diminishes and how do we hold on to that new knowledge of the importance of local?
Well, I think some of it is about influencing the practice of local authorities and the public sector more broadly, and you know, encouraging them to take the learning from this crisis about the value and importance of the local and community level activity, you know, and to encourage them not to forget it. I mean, what we've seen is that in areas where local authorities have worked collaboratively with community sector organisations like big local groups, the response has been much more effective than in areas where, you know, those connections haven't been made. There hasn't been that sort of collaboration. So I think that's something it's going to be very important to foster and encourage going forward.
And I mean, that's a really sort of practical how we do things on the ground differently. And I think that's absolutely right. And anyone who listens to this podcast knows that I'm a bit of a local government geek. So that I'm always interested in responses on that level. But are there public policy responses that you think that we should also be seeing?
Well, I guess our big idea, the big idea that we've been trying to promote for the last year or so, is that we need a new independent endowment called the Community Wealth Fund to support communities in the most left behind areas. Mm. And I think what we're really interested in with that fund is that it would support communities in areas that we believe are left behind, because not only are they the most deprived, but they're also the areas that lack civic assets, you know, by which we mean places for people to meet, an engaged community, and physical and digital connectivity. We commissioned research from OXI that was published last year. Mm-hmm. OXI produced the Index of Multiple Deprivation for Government. And that shows that people who live in neighbourhoods that are deprived and that lack civic assets have worse socioeconomic outcomes than people living in equally deprived areas where such assets are present. So school attainment, higher education participation, health and unemployment are all markedly worse, and the gap is growing. And I think, you know, it's an obvious thing to say, but post-COVID-19, the situation is likely to be even more bleak. So we're asking government to invest the next wave of dormant assets. So that's the orphaned assets from stock, shares, bonds and insurance policies, which are estimated at valuing around $2 billion, into a community wealth fund to support those communities.
And I mean, just going back to the 106, isn't it, areas of multiple deprivation? Have I got that right?
206 areas that we've defined as the most left behind.
And that's this research by Oxy. And you've got sort of different, it's not just that they're the poorest areas, is it? It's also that they're lacking in this infrastructure.
It's that they're lacking in civic infrastructure, yes. And as I said, we define that as places for people to meet, high levels of community engagement and good connectivity, both transport connectivity and digital connectivity. And that's important because it enables people to access economic opportunities in the wider geography.
And so would part of what you would be looking to do with this fund, I mean, I don't know how much you would want to tie certain activities to it, but would part of it be investing in that infrastructure?
Yes, because I think our experience from Big Local is that when you give communities the say-so over resources, you know, when you say to them, determine your own priorities. And we would want, with the Community Wealth Fund, we would want communities to determine priorities for the spend. But what they tend to do is, as a starting point at least, what they tend to do is invest in making sure there's somewhere to meet, in funding activities which bring the community together to build community spirit. And what they also start to look at is this issue of connectivity, and they start to try and, for example, broker access to jobs in the wider geographical area. And I think that what we're seeing is that sort of investment is really foundational. So if you like, it puts in place the foundations so that communities can improve their social and economic prospects, because once they've got those things in place, they can often leverage in funding from other sources to fund specific activities, whether that be community housing or health provision. They can get engaged in social prescribing, but they need a basic level of infrastructure or community skills and capacity on which to build that.
And have you had any, I don't know how much you've already pushed this idea. Have you had much take up?
We're really pleased with the traction that the Community Wealth Fund has been getting. So we've got an alliance of organisations that are supporting the proposal. We've now got over 200 civil society and some public and private sector organisations joined up to the alliance. It includes all the main civil society umbrella organisations like NCVO, Akivo and Locality. Many of the independent funders like the Paul Hamlin Foundation, Lloyds Bank Foundation, Joseph Rowntree, some large national charities, and shed loads of small grassroots charities and community groups. And recently we've had a push on recruiting local authority members. We've been really pleased with that. We've been getting good traction. So that's been fantastic. We've also been working to develop political support, and that's going well. So that's really good too.
So in terms of political support, I mean, it doesn't feel to me like it should belong to one political tradition or the other necessarily. You can see an argument from, say, a big society perspective or a more socialist perspective. So have you managed to open doors on both sides?
Yes, we have. I mean, it's been quite an interesting process because we went to see a whole range of MPs and peers about the Community Wealth Fund proposal initially, and a number of them suggested that we set up an all-party parliamentary group. And so that's the thing we've been working on recently. And we have found that the idea has resonance both with Conservative and Labour MPs and peers. So yes, as you say, I think it is something that sort of cuts across the political divide. And you know, that I've actually found that really heartening.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, and I've been really, I've been really pleased to see how many, MPs can really understand the need for what we're proposing and, you know, are very keen to advocate and help us to make it happen.
And just to play devil's advocate for a moment, we are about to and are most certainly currently experiencing an enormous economic crunch that's going to make 2008 look like nothing. Won't the government want to do other things with that £2 billion right now?
I'm sure there'll be lots of competing demands for the next wave of dormant assets and the £2 billion. However, it's a principle that found money like that, you know, so the dormant assets, that they should go to good causes rather than be spent on public sector priorities. And I think at the moment it is quite difficult to argue that that money shouldn't go to the community level, mm-hmm. and that it shouldn't go and that it shouldn't go direct to communities for them to meet their own priorities. Because I think, you know, there's a real issue about disenfranchisement, you know, and a view that there are lots of communities that have felt forgotten and left behind, and that we really need to do something to give them more of a sense of agency and, you know, to help them turn their areas around and improve their quality of life. And I think that, you know, old sort of top-down approaches, you know, where people were told what they needed and delivery models were imposed on them, just haven't worked. And we really need to try something that's different and more radical. And that really plays to people's potential, because you know what's amazing about our areas is the levels of skill and resourcefulness and creativity. If you trust local people, they can come up with solutions that we would say are really innovative and exciting, and they would say it's just common sense. You know, it's just the thing that we know will work in this area because we know the people and we know the environment. We know what's tried before. We know what doesn't work. And so there's something really powerful about that. And our sense, well, our experience is the parliamentarians, the politicians that we're talking to about it really understand it. They really get the argument.
Yeah, it seems to me that what you have in many ways is the perfect confluence of the pre-COVID narrative of left behind areas, people feeling unlistened to. That was a huge part of the recent general election. And then an absolute solid example of communities delivering for communities in the current world. So it seems to me you have two very, very powerful prongs of narrative there, ready to make these arguments once we come out the other side.
Yes, no, I think that's definitely the case. And some of the feedback that we're getting from MPs is that it is the areas that had the civic assets or infrastructure that we think of as really important that have coped best in this crisis. And so there's something there as well about how you build resilient communities. And, you know, there are going to be shocks in the future, aren't there? There might not be public health shocks, but, you know, they could easily or are likely to be environmental shocks. And I think that's also, you know, that issue of community resilience is something that I think will also garner much more attention. There will be more of a public policy focus on it. And I think we also, you know, the work of big local areas also speaks very well to that agenda.
Absolutely. No, well, it feels to me like you've got a lot of tools in your toolbox ready to go. How, with the areas that are just sort of starting out, are they coping? Or, I mean, there are clear, you know, delineations between those areas that are sort of getting together and coping and doing well and those that aren't. And is there anything that you guys are able to do to help those who are earlier on their journey?
Well, I guess our big local areas, because they have received funding from the programme, have significant capacity on which to build. I think my concern is for, you know, other areas, you know, the areas that don't work with, you know, left behind areas that haven't had that same sort of investment and attention. And I don't think, I mean, we anyway don't have much intelligence about how they are doing. We have launched a major research program that will be looking at our areas and that will be comparing them with other areas that haven't had the same investment, you know, as regards the impact of and the response to COVID-19. So if you ask me that question in a few months, I'll have a reasonable answer. So sorry about that. I don't have a good
answer. No, not at all. We can't expect to have, and I think actually one of the key learnings and one of the things that most interests me about both the big lottery fund, but also the attempt with the community welfare fund, is that you don't ask people to have all the answers at the beginning, and the whole approach is to expect them not to. And I think that's a really useful approach and a rare one.
Yeah, no, I think it's something that's really innovative and different about the program. And I think the other thing that it's important to say as well, I guess, is the fact that it's long term, you know, the fact that this is 10 to 15 years investment in areas is the other thing that's really important. So, you know, it's incredibly patient money. And that means that people can make, you know, small errors and, you know, they can regroup and get back on track. Mm. And that's fine. That's great. You know, they have capacity to take small risks and to learn and to develop, and that's a really important element.
And they don't feel they have teachers sort of standing over them.
No, I think that we're pretty good at being non-judgmental. I mean, that's definitely one of our values, and
that comes very clear across very clearly in the literature. Great. Well, I mean, it sounds like a fascinating ongoing project. Look forward to seeing the research about the impact. I think that would be very useful, and particularly useful for making the case going forward. If you know, investment that has impact is always a more attractive proposition, especially when money is scarce.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining me. Is there anything that we haven't covered? Anything else that you'd like to add?
No, I think that's fine, Emma. Of course, I'll think of lots of things.
Of course.
This evening, but I think for now that's all I can think of. Thank you ever so much. It's been a pleasure to speak to you.
Well, thank you for joining me. Just like to say a quick thank you to Kevin McLeod at incompetech.com for our theme tune, and this is a Political Human production.